Hey everybody, welcome back to the Percy Jackson Son of Poseidon podcast. This is going to be my part 2 review for the Battle of the Labyrinth. So, we left off with our 4 core members this time, Annabeth, Percy, Grover, and Tyson, as they make their way past the Sphinx and follow the mechanical spider to Hephaestus' forge. Before they can get there, Grover has an overwhelming sense that he needs to split up and take another path because he believes he can find Pan. So Tyson volunteers to go with Grover to help him, while Percy and Annabeth continue on to the forge. And it's kind of a nice moment because Grover and Tyson have had sort of a timid, contentious relationship a bit. Tyson being afraid of satyrs and Grover being afraid of cyclopses. They haven't always gotten, you know, along quite well. But this book kind of sets them up. Earlier, they were teamed up for the match, and then now they're, you know, Tyson is being brave and wanting to go help Grover. So it's kind of a nice little moment between them. And then we finally meet the god Hephaestus, who has been mentioned ever since the first book, so I'm kind of surprised it took this long for us to finally meet him. He's the husband of Aphrodite, and so he's been mentioned many times throughout these books. And they're hoping that he can lead them to Daedalus, but Hephaestus only agrees to help them if they investigate one of his forges that he has at the volcano Mount St. Helens. And so Percy and Annabeth make their way to the volcano, and they find that it's being used by monsters called Telekines for Luke's army. And so Percy tells Annabeth to go back to warn Hephaestus while he stays to fight the Telekines. And Annabeth is, you know, kind of scared about losing Percy at this point, and so before she leaves, she gives him a little kiss. And it's kind of a cute moment for them because, you know, they've slowly been building up this interest in each other, and especially for Annabeth, she's, you know, kind of dropped little hints here and there. And, you know, she doesn't know if she's going to see Percy again, so she's kind of like, you know, wanting to make that last, you know, she wants to kiss him in case she never gets a chance to. So it's kind of a cute little moment for them. And then, you know, in order to defeat the Telekines, Percy ends up summoning the water power from within him. And it kind of becomes too much, and he ends up blowing up the volcano. And it sends him flying in the air, and he wakes up landing on the island of Ogygia with Calypso, a daughter of Atlas who was outcasted for siding with Atlas during the Old Titan War. And so Percy is, you know, he used too much of his power, he's overdrained, and so he's resting and recovering at Calypso's island, and he's kind of enamored with her and her beauty and her kindness and everything, and, you know, he stays there to heal, and then Hephaestus comes to see him. I'm not sure how Hephaestus found him, but he comes to see him, and he gives Percy another clue about how to find Daedalus. While Calypso offers Percy to stay with her, because occasionally she has these people that wash up on her island, but they never want to stay forever. So she offers that to Percy, and Percy is a little bit tempted at first, but he does make the decision to leave and go help his friends. So Percy then takes a raft off of Calypso's island and ends up in New York, and he goes back to Camp Half-Blood just as they're, like, having this funeral, and Annabeth's giving, like, this eulogy because they all think Percy's dead. It's been, like, a week. And so Percy then shows up, and everybody's surprised, and then he tells Annabeth and Chiron, you know, what happened, and he tells them about his dream that, you know, he had a dream that Luke had found a half-blood in the labyrinth, and they just assume that that half-blood is probably Nico. And Chiron tells Percy that Quintus has gone missing in the labyrinth, which seems a little weird and suspicious, but, you know, he does leave behind his hellhound dog, Mrs. O'Leary, so Percy's kind of like, well, that's kind of weird, you know, he's kind of like, I'm not sure what's going on with Quintus anymore. And then Percy explains he knows how to find the maze, and he goes back to his mom's house in New York to let her know he's okay, and he wants to make a phone call to Rachel Elizabeth Dare. Because Rachel can see through the mist, Percy thinks that she'll be able to see the way through the labyrinth. I'm not 100% sure how this all works, but apparently Rachel is special and she could see the way through the labyrinth. And And that's kind of what Hera was saying earlier to Percy, that Percy knows the way, and that's because he knows Rachel Elizabeth Dare. And so they go to Rachel, and they meet up with her, and, you know, there's a, you know, a little bit of a jealous moment with Annabeth, you know, obviously being jealous of Rachel. And, you know, Percy is just, like, totally clueless. But Rachel says that she's seen the mark of Daedalus before, and so she takes them to the entrance of the maze that she knows about. So Rachel, once they're in there, she explains that she can kind of just see things that the other two can't, and so she kind of leads them off on, you know, a path through the maze. But after a while, they hear a noise, and before they can escape, they're captured by Kelly, the Impusa, the cheerleader lady from the beginning, and then some Dracaena helpers of hers, and they're taken to the arena of Antaeus, who is a half-giant son of Poseidon and claims to be Poseidon's favorite and has all these arena battles and kills in the name of Poseidon and stuff. And he's also the son of Gaia, too, so son of Poseidon and Gaia. And Percy is forced to fight the half-blood that Luke found, which is not Nico. It is actually Ethan Nakamura, who Annabeth remembers from camp several years ago. So Percy, he fights Ethan, but he doesn't kill him. And instead, he insists on fighting Antaeus. And so, since Antaeus is the son of Gaia, Mother Earth, as long as he's touching the ground, he can't be killed. He'll just reheal himself with the Earth. So Percy ends up tricking him and gets him tangled up in the chains above and hanging above the ground where he can't reheal his wounds. So Percy kind of slashes him and takes him out. And of course, Luke and his army are there, and Luke's upset. And so Percy then uses the ice whistle that Quintus gave him, and it summons Mrs. O'Leary, the Hellhound. And Mrs. O'Leary kind of helps them fight off Luke's army, distracts them for a while Percy, Rachel, Annabeth, and Ethan escape. But Ethan says that Percy shouldn't have let him go, and he kind of leaves the group. And so then Percy, Rachel, and Annabeth make their way towards Daedalus' workshop. And then this is where we get the reveal that Quintus is actually Daedalus in an automaton body, his fifth automaton body, hence the name Quintus. And Percy and Annabeth try to convince Daedalus to help them, but it turns out that Daedalus had already planned on helping out Luke as a way to, like, continue living on forever or something. And so, but then Kelly and the ghost of King Minos arrive, and then followed by Nico, and Kelly kind of double-crosses Daedalus. She's like, yeah, that's an old deal, we're not doing that no more. And that obviously upsets Daedalus. And so the fight breaks out at the workshop. Rachel has them grab these Daedalus metal wings, kind of like the ones we saw he had for him and Icarus when they were flying, but these are a little bit more advanced. And so the fight breaks out, and then Rachel, Percy, Annabeth, and Nico use the wings to fly out of the workshop, which just happens to be over, like, Colorado Mountains or something. And the workshop, I think, like, blows up. And then when they land on the ground, they need to look for a new entrance to the maze. And then we get, like, a little hint that something is different about Rachel, because she's able to, like, summon a private car and to drive them around the city. But then they find the entrance to the maze, and Percy senses something down a tunnel, and he goes to investigate wearing Annabeth's cap of invisibility. Percy finds the Telekines, and he sees a golden sarcophagus, just like the one that, you know, Cronus' body was in. And so he has the cap on, he sneaks up to the sarcophagus, but when he opens it, he sees that it's not Cronus, it's actually Luke's body in the coffin. And the Telekines then tell Ethan Nakamura that he needs to pledge his allegiance to Cronus, and so he does. And when he does, Percy kind of reveals himself to them, but Cronus then rises inside Luke's body. And before a fight can break out, Rachel, Annabeth, and Nico come to save Percy. And Nico ends up using his powers, like, he can control, like, the ground and stuff, like, open up chasms and make walls and stuff. And so Nico uses his powers to help them escape, which Percy tells him, like, that's kind of a bad idea. Now they know you're the son of Hades, and they're going to come for you. But Nico doesn't really care, because he's kind of had a little bit of a change of heart, and he wants to help Percy. And then, so back in the labyrinth tunnel, Percy finds Grover's Rostacap. And so the four of them follow a trail, and they find Tyson with an unconscious Grover. And then Annabeth figures out that they're actually under the Carlsbad Caves in New Mexico, because in the last book, when they were in New Mexico, that's when Grover could feel the presence of Pan. And so the group then goes and finds Pan, the god of the wild. And Pan reveals that it's time for him to die. He needs to be let go. And all the satyrs need to stop searching for him. And of course, Grover doesn't want to accept this. He wants, you know, Pan to come back. He wants to, you know, prove himself. I found Pan, you know. And so it's actually really good for Grover's character arc. And Pan has chosen Grover to carry out this message because, you know, Grover has been the most sincere, I think, and the most believing in that Pan is still alive, and he wanted it more. And Pan can kind of sense that Grover has that spirit that he needs. And so Pan tells Grover that he needs to, you know, take this message and spread it to all the satyrs, and it's up to them now to restore the wild. And, you know, like I said, it's a great scene because this is the mission that Grover has been, we've put Grover on since the first book. You know, the first book, that's what he really wanted most. The second book, he started when he got his searcher's license. And it's, you know, what he's been wanting to do. So it's kind of nice that we tie up this little character story for Grover. So then after Pan dies, the group makes their way back through the labyrinth to New York. Percy calls the Pegasi in, Blackjack and his friends, to come carry them to Camp Half-Blood. But we have to say goodbye to Rachel Elizabeth Dare because she can't go to Camp Half-Blood. And it's revealed that she is the daughter of this rich business real estate mogul. And so she feels guilty because her father is a part of the reason why, you know, the destruction of the wild that Pan had mentioned. And I think he even told her, like, don't blame yourself or something. And so we find out that she's actually just a rich girl. And that's kind of why she doesn't like to talk about her parents, because she doesn't really approve of, you know, what they do. And so it's kind of interesting. We get a little bit more about Rachel, and, you know, she, you know, tells Percy to call her or something. And so we say goodbye to Rachel. And then the Percy, Annabeth, Grover, Nico, and Tyson head back to Camp Half-Blood. And they tell, you know, they tell Chiron everything that happened. And the campers, they've been preparing for a battle anyway. And so Kronos and Luke's body, their army breaks through the labyrinth and they attack the camp. And just when things are kind of turning bad on them, you know, they're getting overwhelmed by Camp A and all the you know, the other creatures, Daedalus and Mrs. O'Leary show up, followed by Briares. So they show up just in time to help take out Camp A, and then Grover makes this loud, strange noise that's later to be revealed the panic cry, named after Pan, and it's a cry that Pan used during the Titan War, and it basically is like, you know, nails on a chalkboard to monsters. Like, they just, it hurts their ears. And so the Titan's army then retreats back into the labyrinth. And so Daedalus then explains that he needs to finally die so that it will shut down the labyrinth. He gives Annabeth his research and says that, you know, she will be a greater architect than he was. And so Nico then uses his powers to take away Daedalus' soul from his automaton body. Nico's original plan was to use that soul to bring back Bianca. But he's decided that Bianca's gone, she needs to rest. And he's not going to bring his sister back. So it's a good character moment for Nico. It's a good arc because, you know, he's finally moved on from Bianca's death and no longer blames Percy. And then after the battle, Grover is summoned by the Council of Cloven Elders, who do not believe his story about Pan dying, and they want to exile him. But then Dionysus comes back from his little side mission where he's been, like, you know, recruiting people and seeing the damage of, you know, the monsters and stuff. And so, Dionysus comes back and he sides with Grover. He believes Grover. And so, and I think there's some sort of connection because Dionysus is the god of wine, and he can control, like, you know, vineyards and vines and stuff, and which I think that is maybe somewhat connected to the wild. So I think Dionysus has some sort of intuition that Pan has gone, and so he believes Grover, and so they disband the Council of Cloven Elders because they're just these old satyrs that are grumpy and don't want to believe Grover. And so it's up to Grover to spread the message that Pan gave him, to the rest of the satyrs. And then at dinner time, Percy talks to Nico, and Nico says that he can't stay at camp because Hades is not welcomed at camp. There is actually not a cabin for children of Hades. And this is kind of confirmed later by Hera. And so Nico decides to go off on his own to answer some questions, to find the answers. You know, like, who was that guy that got him and Bianca out of the Lotus Hotel? You know? And so Dionysus then comes up to talk to Percy, and he thanks him and Annabeth for helping to save the camp. And it's revealed that Dionysus was able to cure Chris Rodriguez's, you know, insanity. And we see that Clarice is, you know, happy sitting next to Chris, and they're being happy. And, you know, that's kind of a nice little touch of that. Dionysus also lost a son, so he's feeling a little bit more vulnerable. But so it's nice kind of seeing a nicer side to Dionysus, knowing that he's not a complete jerk. He, you know, does have some feelings, and he does care to an extent. He just comes off very aloof, though, most of the time. And then at the end of the summer camp, Percy and Annabeth are greeted by Hera again, and she says that she had been helping them the whole time through the maze. And Percy and Annabeth aren't really grateful, though, and they kind of end up insulting her, which kind of makes her mad. And that, I'm not sure if that's going to come back, if Hera's going to, like, hold a grudge against that or what. But also Annabeth finally tells Percy the last part of the prophecy. So the prophecy was, "You shall delve in the darkness of the endless maze, the dead, the traitor, and the lost one raise. You shall rise or fall by the Ghost King's hand, the child of Athena's final stand. Destroy with the hero's final breath, and lose a love to worse than death." And that last line, Annabeth didn't tell Percy about because, you know, she was worried about who, you know, she was going to lose. And so the prophecy breaks down as, you know, Annabeth and the group, they go into the labyrinth. Nico raises the dead, while Ethan Nakamura was the traitor, and the lost one was Pan. Nico is the Ghost King, and he chooses to save Percy and Annabeth's lives. Daedalus is a child of Athena, and he makes his final stand by sacrificing himself to destroy the labyrinth. And Luke is a loved one that has given his body to Kronos, which is, you know, fate worse than death. And so, it's interesting how that prophecy kind of played out. I think, you know, we couldn't have predicted Ethan Nakamura would be a traitor because he was a character we just found out about. And, you know, we couldn't have predicted it was about Daedalus because we didn't know Quintus was Daedalus. So it's a little bit more of a trickier prophecy this time because there was a lot of unknowns going into the prophecy. And then, of course, Percy doesn't understand why, you know, Annabeth keeps defending Luke and why, you know, she loves him when he's working for Kronos. But Annabeth explains that, you know, they have a complicated history and relationship because, you know, he was there for her, you know, when she got to, you know, they had this whole journey of getting to camp. She was the only one that he was the only one that cared about her. And, you know, they just have this past, you know, and that Percy just can't understand. But I'm still kind of on Percy's side of, like, you know, he's evil now. But, you know, it is more complicated than that. And then before Percy leaves, there's kind of a sweet moment where he almost tells Annabeth about how he feels about her, kind of. I think he was going to say that to her. But he gets interrupted and he has to go. And then so the book ends with Percy celebrating his 15th birthday with his mom, her boyfriend Paul Blofus, and Tyson. And then Poseidon, Percy's father, he comes and stops by, which is kind of cool. And he tells Percy that he is his favorite son. Because Percy was worried. It's like, why would Antaeus be his favorite son? This guy is clearly a monster. And Poseidon explains that, you know, Antaeus, you know, only thinks he's my favorite son, and he does bad things to honor me, but that doesn't mean I approve. You are my favorite son, Percy. So it's kind of a nice, sweet moment. I think it's kind of something that Percy needed to hear, some sort of acknowledgement and affirmation from his father. And then Poseidon gives Percy a sand dollar, and he tells him, spend it well. So I'm not sure where the sand dollar is going to come into play in the next book or not. And then Nico appears at the window with some information about, I think, fighting Kronos. And then that's just where the book ends. It's just Percy invites Nico in for a birthday cake, which you could tell Nico has never probably had birthday cake before. You know, and he's a very sad, tragic character, Nico, his life and stuff. So I like that he's warmed up to Percy and that they're getting along. And then that's, you know, actually where the book ends. And it's nice having a happy ending to the book, you know. And I like, you know, there's a lot of moving parts in this book, which is interesting. But I think it does do a good job setting the stage for the last book. We've kind of wrapped up a few things here. You know, like the Grover side mission, the, you know, Luke forming the army and attacking. Like, so we've wrapped up, you know, and Kronos rising Luke's body. So we've kind of wrapped up a lot of things that really set the stage for the next book. And so, I like all of that stuff that we got. You know, I love seeing Poseidon coming at the end, and him and Sally have a brief interaction, which we'll get out a little bit more. But I like his talk with Percy and everything. And he feels more accepting of Percy and has some confidence in him, which I like. And I do feel a little bit bad of how we leave off Annabeth, but I like that she got her own quest finally, which is nice. I also really like paying off Daedalus' story and the reveal that he was Quintus. You know, we got all these dreams of Percy, you know, about Daedalus and him losing his son and then, you know, killing his nephew and, you know, working with the daughters to kill King Minos and stuff. And then we kind of pay off his story at the end of him sacrificing himself. So I do like that as well. And I also like the ending with Dionysus. Seeing like a slightly nicer side to Dionysus is good. And, you know, he lost a son. And I think it just gives him a little bit more empathy as a character. Right? He's not the jerk that we just thought he was. So it's a little late in the series to do that with Dionysus. But I think it comes at an appropriate time for the character. And so I think this book just does a good job continuing to build the characters we've already met. Like Clarice, you know, she gets her own little kind of subplot with Chris Rodriguez. And we learn that, you know, she does have feelings. She has feelings for Chris. She, you know, can have a caring side for somebody. She's not a complete, you know, antagonistic person all the time. She does have a softer side to her. And that's really nice to see. So I do like that. And then, of course, you know, we pay off Grover's arc, you know, get a little bit more of Annabeth. And I'm also happy that we didn't kill off Rachel Elizabeth Dare, because, you know, I was a bit sad to see all the cool female characters, like, in the last book die. Like, Zoe died, Bianca died, and, you know, we lost Thalia to the Hunters. Like, we lost all those cool female characters. And so I was happy that we didn't kill off Rachel Elizabeth Dare in this, because I like her as a character. And I'm not sure if she's going to come back or not, but I hope so. I'd like to see her again. And so, you know, there's a lot of good stuff in this book. I like travel. I like using the labyrinth to travel across all these different places. That was a lot of fun. You know, we get to see a lot of, you know, we go back to San Francisco. We go to Alcatraz Island. You know, we go to, you know, the ranch was cool. We go to a volcano. We get to see Calypso's Island, which is kind of cool. So we're pulling out a lot of these more mythological Greek characters and monsters, which is always fun. So, yeah, so I really liked this book. I didn't have a good sense of what was going to happen going into it. I just knew we were in the labyrinth, and that's pretty much all I knew. And Daedalus was there, and that's pretty much all I knew. So I do like how this book progressed, and I like where it went, and how it completed some things, and then set up the next book. So this is a good book. I don't know where I'd rank it just yet with all of the books. I'll do my final ranking after I read the last book. But I think it's a solid book. So anyway, so yeah, that's my thoughts for the second half of the book of Percy Jackson and the Olympians, The Battle of the Labyrinth. I really enjoyed it this time, and we didn't get a whole lot of new characters, but that's fine. We didn't really have room for them. But we did do a lot of good stuff with the characters we've already established, so that's good. So yeah, those are my thoughts. Let me know what you guys think about the book in the comments below. Stay tuned to my part 3 discussion, where I'll review the book as a whole and the characters and the story arcs and everything. So that's it for this episode of the Percy Jack Son of Poseidon podcast. Bye.